When I was a child, we had placemats in our house of the map of the United States. They were plastic laminate, colorful and pleasing to the eye. We would have them out in the morning. I'd pour over the map while eating my Cheerios. The different contours, divisions, and boundaries of the map fascinated me. I wondered what it was like in Arizona or Rhode Island, confined as I had been to the South and the Midwest. I dreamed of traveling to visit them all. The map of the United States offered me a way of making sense of the world, of framing what was knowable. I never truly considered that it had not always been this way, that others might map this land very differently. I kept my affinity for maps as I grew older, loving the promises they seemed to hold. As I entered divinity school, I took a class with Oglala Lakota professor Dr. Tinker, and I began to question what these maps meant. You see, many early settlers who would become Americans believed that they had a special covenant with God that laid a foundation for what we call manifest destiny. A covenant, as we know, is an agreement between two parties, and in this case, one of those parties was believed to be divine. Were we not meant to have this land, to be an example to the world? Are we not a chosen people, the belief insisted? Take these words from John Winthrop, governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Winthrop delivered his lay sermon just before he and his fellow passengers disembarked on the shore of Boston Harbor, the place Winthrop proposed, to which God had called them to build up a model Bible commonwealth for Protestants in England and elsewhere to emulate. Thus stands the cause between God and us. We are entered into covenant with him. For this work, we have taken out a commission. He declared, adding, if the Lord shall please to hear us and bring us in peace to the place we desire, then hath he ratified this covenant and sealed our commission, and will expect a strict performance of the articles contained in it. Inherent in this covenant was the assumption that the model biblical commonwealth was far superior to the lives the native people were already living throughout the continent. Indeed, covenant twists dangerously into coveted, as the idea of manifest destiny provided a perfect rationale to take land again and again from Indian nations who stood in the way of the American dream. The fact is, many American people conceived that they were God's chosen people and used the biblical story of God's covenant with Abraham to bring his people into the promised land to justify taking America. The fact is, we all live on stolen land. I had been raised to believe that I could be and do anything, that I could go anywhere. And this is what it meant to be an American. For better or for worse, this idea of covenant has been subtly passed on to me as I have been invited to live out my own vision of the shining example to the world. This dream of manifest destiny was embedded into the laminate placemat of the United States I studied as a child. It looks so innocent, doesn't it? It turns out that if we go back to the early maps of this country, we find they are also often quite misleading. The maps of early America depict the world not as it was, but as the colonists hoped it would be. In reality, there was something standing in the settlers' way as they sought to create this world, the neat boundaries of states stretching ever westward, and that was the Indians. For most of the history of the United States, our government was forced to recognize and negotiate between two different maps of the world, one full of states and the other of Native American nations. Depending on the map we look at, we're going to see a very, very different world. This sermon is about maps and covenant, but it is also about the history of Unitarianism and Unitarian Universalism. It's easy for us to forget that our story, too, is intertwined with the cession of land. Our story is part of the American story. Certainly, as Unitarians, we have a long history of being on the forefront of social change, and that is to be celebrated. Our seven principles today outline our commitment to one another and to the world. However, we also need to look at the ways we have done harm. Even in our best intentions, we have hurt the cultures and the lives of others. This is not a call to wallow in guilt or shame, but to hold dark and light together as we move forward. The health of our souls is at stake if we keep only to the light. In 2009, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, Bill Sinkford, issued a formal apology to the Ute Nation as represented by Forrest Kutch, who was present at our General Assembly in Salt Lake City. Are you aware of the historic relationship between the Unitarians and the Utes? I admit I was not until last year when a colleague shared an article on the subject. At first, as I delved into studies with Dr. Tinker at Iliff School of Theology, first on Native American religious traditions and then on early Christianity and Indian genocide, I felt a heavy weight of grief upon me. Yet this weight was not new at all. Rather, this knowledge seemed to make visible a weight that I have been carrying all my life. The inexplicable sadness that comes over me, the anger I feel at the world, is in large part illuminated by the untold history of settler and native relations. When I hold this grief and sit with it, the grief transforms. In the midst of this transformation, a new idea of covenant is born. Let's return to that idea in a moment. But what I want to do now is begin our history of maps, Unitarianism, and America by going back closer to the country's founding. Let's look here at this map of the United States as of 1703. Now, Unitarians were already well established in New England. Harvard College, established in 1636, is an intellectual center for the liberal elite. All the land in this image, it should be noted, used to belong to native peoples. Indeed, let us compare this map to the next, and we start to see some striking incongruities. In the first, we see that Georgia claims a large area of land under its jurisdiction, but the reality is most of this land is occupied by independent, self-governing Indian nations who do not recognize that state's claim to their territory. In the case of Georgia, the Cherokee Nation happens to occupy much of their map. A map is an idea, an interpretation of the world. A map is not reality. Moving to the next picture, we see land cessions between 1820 and 1839. Here we are at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. This brings us to the story of Reverend Henry Frederick Bond. Henry Bond hailed from Boston, born in 1820 to a wealthy family. He graduated from Harvard in 1840 and Harvard Divinity School in 1845, became a Unitarian minister. Before his divinity degree, he traveled to India and other places, seeming to exhibit a wanderlust and passion for people of different cultures that would shape his later life. Bond served churches in Massachusetts and New Hampshire before answering the call to move westward to minister to a frontier community in Omaha, Nebraska. Let's take a look at the next map. It shows ceded land between 1840 and 1859. Omaha had only been founded in 1854 after settlers had first illegally occupied the area and then negotiated later for the land cession from the Omaha tribe. This is the country as it was when Bond entered the ministry. Henry Bond went out to Omaha in 1869. So let's move to the next slide, ceded land from 1860 to 1869. to 1879. This map shows an incredible change from all the previous ones. Although a few large swaths of land had been acquired quickly before, now, for the first time, most of the remaining land is being appropriated by the U.S. government. The pace of land cession is accelerating. So in 1874, Reverend Henry Bond arrived at Los Pinos, Colorado. Bond had accepted an appointment as the government agent to the Mountain Ute Tribe. The American Unitarian Association was charged with operating Ute agencies in Colorado. He spent 2 years among the Utes. Reports vary as to why he left, citing a shortage in the cattle fund, or alternatively that this was all that his always frail body could stand. Henry Bond served a few churches back in New England before returning to the West in 1886. During his absence, however, much had changed. The American Unitarian Association had made a pledge, a covenant, if you will, to assist the Ute people. There apparently was no longer any Unitarian willing to take the post of an agent. So Nathan C. Meeker, not a Unitarian, but he worked with the American Unitarian Association, was appointed as the last Ute agent. He was not a pleasant man, and very forcibly tried to change the Ute's way of life to individuated plots of subsistence agriculture, which resulted in much hunger and poverty. A bad situation under the previous Unitarian agents quickly became desperate. Violence broke out. Lives were lost on both sides, including Meeker's, and the Utes were forcibly removed from their ancestral lands to a reservation in Utah. The Utes suffered the same fate as many nations before them. This takes us to the next map. Here, land cession from 1880 to 1972. Having missed all the turmoil, in 1886, Reverend Bond returned to the Utes, now in Utah, to establish a boarding school. He was not successful there due to a lack of sufficient encouragement. I wonder why. Bond relocated with his wife to start a boarding school in Montana in the Crow Indian Reservation. The school was known as the Montana Industrial School for Indians, or Bond's Mission. To quote from Unitarianism in America, published in 1900, "It was the object of the Montana Industrial School to remove the Indian children from their nomadic conditions and give them a practical education with so much instruction in books as would be of real help to them." Indeed, it is likely that Bond did not question that the best way to improve the Indians' condition was to make them as much like the white man as possible. He remained here until he retired in 1891, though the school continued until it was defunded and the land acquired by the government in 1895. Bond spent the remainder of his days in New England until his death in 1907. It's so important to hold the dark and the light together, to embrace all aspects of our history, if we are to move forward as a denomination and as an American people. The story of Reverend Bond is a story of a man trying to do good, and it is the story of our faith's participation in the Utes' subjugation and forced removal from their land. We know now that schools like Bond's Mission participated in cultural genocide, striving to kill the Indian to save the man, as the saying went. The story of America is, in part, a story of willful deceit, a string of broken treaties, a story of violence and greed. In order to fulfill the covenant of God's promised land, Americans again and again broke their agreements with Native nations, following our own laws only when convenient. The story of the Unitarians and the Utes, of Bond's Mission and the Crows, is obscured, lacking in details. Yet we must tell it because this is not a history lesson. This is happening now. As I speak, Native peoples are rallying in North Dakota to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline from pumping tar sands across the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. In this moment, Navajo people are fighting to get clean water when their most precious resource has been poisoned with uranium and spills from uranium mines. In this moment, Native peoples are still suffering the consequences of an American culture and people who only want one thing from them. Everything. Taking in the knowledge of this history has helped make me aware of a huge grief I have been carrying, a grief that was previously unnameable. This grief is still with me, yet I have learned to hold it lightly. Unitarian Universalist activism Tim DeChristopher says a grief like this may be a burden in times of peace and plenty, but in turbulent times, it serves as an anchor. Our grief can keep us grounded, rooted, so that we are not swept away in the storm. Let's return a moment for to the map with land cessions from 1820 to 1839. Bond was born in 1820 into a country still small, teeming with unrealized desire of westward expansion, determined to acquire the land from its current inhabitants. Now moving to the next slide, we can get a sense of how drastically the map changed during Bond's lifetime. Because Indians did not share European culture, many thought they had no culture at all. Because many Indians did not improve the land with the agriculture and industry that became synonymous with civilization, they were deemed to be wasting it, not truly using it at all. Of course, even in such a case as the Cherokee Nation, where European culture was adopted to the extent of creating a constitution and all the recognizable symbols of culture that Americans aspired to, the Cherokee were still forcibly removed from their land. When I was a little boy, I only had one map of the United States to examine. I only had one worldview, one frame of reference from which to examine reality. I hope that our children will see other maps, like this one here, which shows land claims by tribes around 1784. This is an imperfect map and limited, but it begins to offer other possibilities for understanding the world that we live in. If we do not know where we came from, how can we know what is possible? The idea of covenant has been used to commit heinous acts, to exploit and destroy. The idea of covenant has been used to take what we covet from others. Yet, we are a covenantal faith. We come together with the promise of how we want to be. We hold each other accountable for creating the kind of world we dream of. We are called to continue to come together, to renew our promise, though the past and the present are full of pain and darkness. In order to live out our covenantal faith, we must welcome in our grief. From Buddhist eco-philosopher Joanna Macy, I have learned that when we sit with our grief and hold it gently, our grief turns to show its other face. That other face is a deep, true love. I hurt and I grieve because I love this world and the people in it. I love this interdependent web of which we are all a part. As we leave this sanctuary today, may we find the strength to hold the dark and the light together. As Unitarians, we are connected not only to the Ute and the Crow nations, but to the Algonquin language nations of the indigenous people that resided in the Massachusetts area long before the Unitarians, and indeed in some way to all the indigenous peoples of this continent. The reality is that there are many ways to understand our past and many maps to depict the land we all share. As Unitarian Universalists, we are called to understand, to explore, and to honor maps other than the one handed to us by the dominant culture. Honestly, the story of maps gives me hope because it tells a truth about the spiritual state of our nation. May we go forth in that spirit of truth and seek out new maps that give us clues as to how to walk with those who suffer injustices from domination. May we go forth with light and dark together, and may we live out with all indigenous peoples the words President Bill Sinkford spoke to the Ute representatives in 2009. He said, "We participated, however ineptly, in a process that stole your land and forced a foreign way of life on you. We ask for your forgiveness, and we promise to stand with you as you chart your way forward." In this spirit of solidarity, in this commitment to right relationship and a renewed covenant, let us say, Amen, Aho, and blessed be.